I'm going to begin with a news item, of course, that has been headlining, and that's the killing of three Israeli soldiers held by Hamas. I don't know any background to it, apart really from that they were captured. In at least two of them were captured on a kibbutz. The long and the short of it is, though, that they'd escaped, been let go, who the hell knows. They emerge shirtless, waving some sort of white flag, and they're shot. And one survives. Runs forward shouting in Hebrew. I don't know what they were shouting, but I would guess something along the lines of, don't shoot, and he's shot. And the reason why it sort of got me thinking, I'm sure it's the case with other comrades on this forum, is that these individuals, we know their names. We know how old they are. We know what happened to them. But what's happening on the other side is largely anonymous. And what comes to my mind is if you've got Israeli troops that are that trigger happy shooting at their own side, of course, that was an accident. What are they doing to Hamas fighters that are surrendering? What are they doing to civilians who are trying to flee? Under a white flag. There's going to be no inquiry into that. There's going to be no investigation. And indeed, from what I understand, in terms of the killing of these three young men, is that Israel simply wants to pass on to the next question. So relatives have been demonstrating, but we've had no questioning of the military operation from the Israeli side. Meanwhile, the figures are terribly disturbing. 18,800, that's the last figure that I've got. I presume that that's nothing like a full figure. For that, you'd have to look under rubble. There's going to be plenty of bodies that are still to be recovered. But of course, the really worrying thing is what happens to the 1.8 million people that have been displaced, and what happens to the rest of the population in Gaza. 18,800 is a horrendous figure, but my fear is that over the next week, over the next month, who knows how long this horror is going to continue, is that the death rate, not from Israeli bombs, not from Israeli bullets, but it might just as well be that death from disease, that is going to skyrocket. And the World Health Organization, for example, has issued figures saying that diarrhea, which normally is something you get and you're slightly embarrassed by it, but you're over it within a few days. It's a killer in the conditions of Gaza. And what we've seen is a 66% increase in diarrhea in young children. And there are also reports of outbreaks of meningitis, chickenpox, jaundice, hepatitis A. And the danger is, without clean drinking water, without fuel, without medicines, without adequate food coming in, huge numbers, huge numbers. Should be expected to die. Now we've had Britain and Germany come out with a call for a ceasefire, not yet notice, but sometime, a ceasefire that's going to be enduring. How on earth is that going to come about? The United States being making similar noises. Of course, it has the ultimate control when it comes to the supply of bunker busters, ordinary bombs, spare parts for tanks and fighter aircraft, and all the rest of it. But meanwhile, what we have is an Israeli war cabinet which seems determined to carry on until Hamas is wiped out. And of course, the analogy, completely bogus analogy, that the Israeli establishment draws between Hamas and ISIS or Al-Qaeda. This is just a nonsense. The reality is that in the last democratic elections, which were admittedly some time ago, I think it was 2006, but Hamas came out on top. It beat Al-Fatah. It certainly beat the organizations of the left. And my understanding is, for example, in terms of recent opinion poll surveys, for whatever value you put on them, and I certainly don't dismiss them, on the West Bank of Palestine, what we have is Hamas being rated approvingly by something like 78% of the population. So here's an organization that's precisely rooted in the Palestinian population, and it's clear that Israel's goal isn't to, pinpoint Hamas leaders and eliminate them. It's clear that at the very least, what Israel has in mind is ethnically cleansing the Palestinian population from Gaza. And if they just happen to commit genocide in the process, well, from Israel's point of view, that's a price worth paying. I don't think at the moment they're aiming to wipe out the Palestinian population in Gaza, but the point is that they might as well be aiming for that. When you uproot 1.8 million people, when you deny them clean drinking water, when you deny them medicines, when you deny them fuel, when you deny them food, that's what happens. People die in huge numbers very, very quickly. And that is precisely the danger over the next few weeks. Now, in terms of Britain and the United States, they proclaim themselves to be concerned, for the fate of these people. In my view, that's crocodile tears. In my view, for what it's worth, what they actually fear is not the deaths of tens and tens and tens of thousands of Palestinian people. What they fear is the reaction to those deaths on the West Bank, but also over the other side of Jordan, the River Jordan, in Jordan itself. What they fear is the reaction in Cairo, Alexandria. What they fear is the reaction in Saudi Arabia. They fear for the stability of the MBS regime. They fear for the stability of the Sisi regime. They fear for the stability of Abdullah the Second. That's actually what they are really concerned about. Okay, just a couple of points on this subject. I think it's profoundly wrong, anyone on the left, to draw an equal sign between Hamas and Israel. It's certainly true that if we look at the ideology of Hamas, it's an Islamic reactionary ideology. If we look at Israel, it's dominated no longer by Labour Zionism, as if that wasn't bad enough. It's now dominated by revisionist Zionism and far, far right Zionism that, has got utter contempt for even paying lip service to a two-state solution. But the reality is, what we're dealing with in terms of Hamas, as I've already indicated, is an organization that's rooted in the mass of the Palestinian people who are an oppressed people. If we're dealing with Israel, certainly what we're dealing with since 1967, and I think you have to actually argue as an actual project going back not only to 47, 48, but before that, what you're dealing with is a settler colonial project that is designed to get rid of the original ha inhabitants of that land and establish an exclusivist, racist by definition, Zionist regime. So, of course, we don't agree with Hamas ideologically. Nonetheless, I think we'd have to classify it as part of the resistance movement in Palestine. And at the moment, clearly from the statistic that I just referred to, the dominant strand in terms of the resistance movement. Now, of course, it's got roots historically, Hamas, in the Muslim Brotherhood. And precisely if we look back at the foundation of the Muslim Brotherhood in 1928, of course it's a reactionary ideology. But nonetheless, it was part of the independence movement against the domination of Egypt. By British imperialism. British imperialism no longer directly ruled, but everyone knew that it was in charge of the king. The king was in charge of the government. Britain controlled the treasury. Egypt was completely at the mercy of British imperialism. We all know that Britain controlled the Suez Canal, had garrisons there, and had under treaty. The right to move anywhere in Egypt in the event of war. So, yeah, Hamas isn't simply just a reactionary organization. It's a reactionary organization that is part of the Palestinian resistance movement to Israeli colonialism. Just thought I'd add my own take on things. I frankly ought to, and I'm being self-critical here, look it up and do a tiny bit of research, but I've heard it so often in terms of other countries and other theatres of war that this is all about minerals, this is all about resources. In the case of Gaza, I'm sure there's gas somewhere out there off the coast under the Mediterranean Sea, whether it's commercially viable, I don't know, but I my own take is that this isn't about gas. This is not about oil. We heard all of that, didn't we, when it came to Iraq. I wasn't convinced at the time. I'm not convinced now. We even heard it when it came to Afghanistan, that there's bauxite or I don't know what, tin, or whatever the hell there is, and I'm sure there is. But that wasn't what Afghanistan was about. That wasn't what Iraq was about. If you take it strategically, the West, but in specific terms, the United States, yes, it backs Israel because it wants to be in a position to dominate, the Middle East, which is one of the world's key sources of oil. And gas. That's true. But to explain Israel on, in terms of its action vis-a-vis Gaza, I think, how should I put it, it completely misses the mark that what we have here is a revenge operation, but also a revenge operation that's part of a bigger picture of establishing Israeli control, Zionist control over the whole of Palestine. And what's surprising, I think, to most of us, not after October the 7th, it has to be admitted, but the surprise is that it's Gaza rather than the West Bank. And it's clear that Israel had its eyes on ethnically cleansing the West Bank, given the slightest opportunity. On the other hand, Gaza, with its 2.4 million people packed in, that wasn't a natural target. But clearly, Israel is driving the population to the south, and the only escape route that they're going to be allowed is into Egypt. And that seems to me where Israeli policy lies. And the United States knows that. Everyone, surely, looking at the present situation, knows that. So it's fear, as I said, that's driving the United States to, well, voice its concern. We'll put it no stronger than that. I just thought, I only read this last night, but I just thought I would raise it. I don't know if other comrades read the Morning Star. I do occasionally. In the CPGB, we sort of have a situation where we try collectively to know what's going on the left. So we, have various comrades who read the Morning Star, Socialist Appeal, Socialist Worker, the Socialist Solidarity. Anyway, I got round to reading the editorial of the Morning Star on November the 26th, or from, I should say, November the 26th, 2023. And the headline was an interesting one. London's March Against Anti-Semitism Poses Difficult Questions for the Left. This is the demonstration in London that Tommy Robinson, the founder of the English Defence League. This is the demonstration that Boris Johnson went on. This is the demonstration that was fronted by the campaign against anti-Semitism. And what the Morning Star, to me, has done is amazingly take it on face value. According to the Morning Star, and I'm sure they're right, I wouldn't argue with this, I'm sure it's right that there's been a significant upturn in anti-Semitic incidents in London and throughout Britain. But I wouldn't take the campaign against anti-Semitism's word for that. I'm simply relying on, well, if you've got a state that claims to be acting on behalf of Jews worldwide, and certainly in Britain, a good slice of the Jewish population identifies with Israel, it doesn't surprise me that you will get instances, increased instances of anti-Semitism. It also ought to be added that a very good slice of the Jewish population in Britain, just like in the United States, will be bitterly, bitterly hostile to Israel. Wouldn't want anything to do with Zionism, let alone what Zionism is doing today to the Palestinians in general, and in particular to the Palestinian population in Gaza. But according to the editorial, according to Ben Chacko, the editor of the Morning Star, this was a genuine march against anti-Semitism. Now, we've seen similar marches in France, and we've seen similar marches in the United States, in Washington, DC. I didn't go down, to have a look at this demonstration, but my own initial reaction to it, looking at the people who were taking part in it, looking at the sponsors of the demonstration, was, well, this isn't really a response to any rise in anti-Semitism, this, to all intents and purposes, is a solidarity demonstration with Israel. This is a Zionist demonstration. And indeed, what you had at the front of the demonstration was a big banner with a Union Jack and two Israeli flags. Israeli flags, the state of Israel, the state that is carrying out this horror in Gaza, this colonial state. Now, my only real experience, and I just think it is worthwhile mentioning in this context of a demonstration by Zionists, again, it wasn't billed in that way, was the Enough is Enough. A demonstration against Jeremy Corbyn in Parliament Square, the demonstration that was addressed by Norman Tebbit and a whole host of Zionist Labourites, along with the DUP and other such, how should I put it, enlightened souls. I found it very interesting. Because my normal company doesn't include Zionists. I mix with plenty of Jewish people, but most of the people I mix with, not surprisingly, I suppose, tend to be militantly anti-Zionists. Anyway, I was on this counter demonstration called by, amongst others, Jewish Voice for Labour. And what struck me, I was carrying the Labour Against the Witch Hunt banner. I don't know why, but no one was confronting me. I had some talks with various people on the other side. Most of them were quite reasonable people. You know, I was saying that this is all nonsense about Jeremy Corbyn being an anti-Semite. There's no anti-Semitism crisis in the Labour Party. Just look at the people who've been targeted, and I list out a load of people and say, well, the thing about them is they're all Jewish, these people that have been expelled, that I've just told you about. Look them up and tell me if they're anti-Semites. But what was interesting is the people who were identifying as Jewish, people holding, you know, Jewish Voice for Labour or other such banners. What I found quite stunning is the vitriol directed at them, including the slogan, which I'd never heard before. And it took me, you know, 3, 4, 5 seconds to work it out, was quote unquote, ghetto Yid, ghetto Yid, ghetto Yid. I had to think about it and went, ah, right, what they're accusing our side of is being Bundists, and what the other side are Zionists. And of course, the BBC, the ITV, Sky, all the journalists that were there, of course, none of that was reported. All we had was the usual stuff about Jeremy Corbyn, the crisis in the Labour Party, and oh, there was a counter demonstration. We did have, I think, if my memory serves me right, on the other hand, a certain Newsnight producer who was going around recording, who didn't record the shouts of Ghetto Yid, but did record one Stanley Keeble, who was having an argument, again, you know, a relatively civilized argument with a Zionist, who, you know, Stan pointed out to the Zionist, well, Hitler, or at least the Hitler regime, I should say, let me get it right. The Hitler regime, the Nazi regime in Germany, was tolerant of Zionism. And indeed, the Zionists in Palestine and the Nazis in Germany even did a trade deal. And it was in return for rich Zionists going over to Palestine. You had the toleration of Zionist organizations. And the Zionist press in the early period of the Nazi regime. That was recorded. That got Stan sacked from his job in a Labour councillor at in a Labour council at the urging of the local Tory MP. But in terms of the character, the political character of the other side, of course, none of that is going to be reported. And it doesn't surprise me that Tommy Robinson wanted to join this demonstration. It doesn't surprise me that Boris Johnson wanted to join this demonstration. He's so well known, isn't he, as being an anti-racist? Well, no, he's not, and nor's Tommy Robinson. So maybe I missed a trick and maybe I should have gone down there. I don't know of any actual left-wing report other than, the pictures. There's a big demonstration. I know on the BBC website, the numbers went up as the reporting, went on. And first of all, the first report I read was 66,000, then it went up to 100,000. And I was even told that one figure that was being, bandied about was 200,000. But the point I wanted to get back to is Ben Chacko of the Morning Star taking this demonstration at face value, that this was a anti, this was a demonstration protesting against anti-Semitism. In my view, it was doing no such thing. And so we had, in terms of this November the 26th editorial, the call to rebuild a mass anti-racist movement that will include prominent Jewish voices. Well, there already are various anti-racist campaigns, and as far as I know, it includes many, many prominent Jewish voices in these campaigns. But what it shouldn't include is Zionist voices, because Zionism is a form of racism. It's a form of racism that says, first of all, Jews and Gentiles cannot live in the same territorial space under the same state, because Gentiles are automatically anti-Semitic, and the Jews need their own homeland. They need their own territory if they're going to establish themselves as a proper people. And if, there's already people there, so what? Even though they, most of them proclaim themselves to be secular, to be atheists, even God gave us this land, and it's ours by right. Okay, so what we also have, and that's just worth mentioning at the end, in the sponsoring organization of the Morning Star, i.e., the Communist Party of Britain, the official, well, sort of official party, we actually have a situation because, in no small measure, due to the prompting and leadership role of the resident Zionist in their ranks, Mary Davis, we actually have a situation, according to my understanding, that the CPB runs anti-Semitism awareness courses. Again, I'm quite stunned by this. I mean, as far as I know, I mean, I do know some of these people. As far as I know, the CPB has no anti-Semitism problem. The CPB isn't rife with anti-Semites. What it is rife with, I would hope, is anti-Zionists. That is something I would expect. And I wouldn't expect an organization, even like the CPB, to legitimize Zionism as some sort of voice that can speak on behalf of Jewish people in the name of anti-racism. But that's what you've got in terms of the CPB and in terms of the Morning Star. Okay, moving on, I wanted to mention Rishi Sunak and Giorgia Meloni, the Prime Minister of Italy, and Rishi Sunak appearing not at a government to government, not a prime minister to prime minister meeting, but appearing on the stage of a political festival organized by Meloni's party the Brotherhood of Italy, which of course is the direct inheritor party of the MSI, which is the direct inheritor party of Mussolini's fascist party. So the MSI, Movement Social Italy, that's not going to do it in Italian, but that's my understanding of the initials. This is the organization that was established post-World War II that eventually becomes the Brotherhood of Italy, which I think myself is best described as post-fascist. But nonetheless, that doesn't mean that the links have been broken. It just means that it is no longer a fascist organization. I wouldn't define it as a fascist organization. But Rishi Sunak appeared alongside Maloney and amongst the others who've graced this festival includes Steve Bannon, Donald Trump's former advisor, Viktor Orban. And as I understand it, this year there was also Elon Musk. And of course, what Maloney and Sunak are making common cause on is the question of migration. And in particular, they're making a great deal of what we could call small boats. This is a big election issue, as far as Sunak is concerned, in Britain. And it's been a big election issue in Italy. So they have something in common. But also, what I would say is they have something in common more than just illegal migration. Before she was successful in terms of becoming prime minister, I think we remarked at the time that when she was being questioned by the media, that, look at what you said about Mussolini, look what you said about fascism in the 1920s and 30s in Italy. Maloney turned around to the press and said, well, actually, if you look at my election manifesto, if you look at the manifesto of the Brotherhood of Italy, it's no different, really, to the Tories in Britain. And really, my reaction to that is, well, exactly. Yes, that's correct. Both are far right parties. And I do find it strange in Britain that somehow an awful lot of the left doesn't quite get it. So in terms of, for example, the comrades in the SWP, they will call Meloni, not like me. They will call her and the Brotherhood of Italy, they call them fascists. But they wouldn't dream of calling the Tory party fascists. I think they're right not to call Rishi Sunak and the Tory party fascist, but they are parties of the extreme right. And it's interesting if we look at them philosophically, we don't just have an obsession with migrants. We have an approach, I think, that you'll find in Roger Scruton. Not a Nazi philosopher, but a conservative philosopher. A conservative philosopher, I would argue broadly, that would have similarities with young England in the mid 19th century, anti-democratic, anti-globalist, wanting to appeal to, home traditional values, which don't, by the way, include democracy. That's our Tory party in terms of its philosophy, in terms of where it gets its inspiration from. And note for those that think that David Cameron, who only remember David Cameron in terms of all the green quote unquote shit and the husky dog and redoing the Tory logo so it had an oak. David Cameron realigned the Tory party when Britain was still in the EU with the far right, including Meloni's party, including the party of Viktor Orban. Rishi Sunak appeared alongside I can't remember his name. I've Santiago Abascal, a Vox, the inheritor party of the Falange, as I understand it, in Spain. That's their natural, how should you put it, co-thinkers. That's their natural habitat. So yeah, David Cameron shifted the Conservative Party over from an alignment with what you could call the centre right, the Christian Democrat right, call it whatever you will. He shifted the Tory Party over to the far right of the European Parliament. Okay. Okay, let's move on. Just two more items. 38 going well. Okay, I just thought I would mention it. It's not of any huge significance, but nonetheless, I think it's of nonetheless of interest. And this is the election in the PCS, in the public sector union, low-level civil servants and the like. I think it's got about 600,000 members. And since 2000, this organization, this trade union, has been led by Mark Sawatka, who's a former member of the Alliance for Workers' Liberty. And this union historically was dominated, at least in terms of my history, was dominated by the hard Cold War right. Can't remember her name, but the general secretary, the last general secretary I remember was Kate someone or other. But there were bitter court battles. There were bitter battles in this union. But the point I'm making is that this union was dominated by the right and is now clearly, unmistakably, thank you, Ben Cousins, is now unmistakably dominated by the left. So the results, low turnout, I emphasize. So the turnout was just over 10%. The turnout was 11.5%. So the winning candidate from the Left Unity faction was Fran Heathcote. She got 10,340 votes. Just behind her was Marion Lloyd of the Broad Left Network. She's a member of the Socialist Party in England and Wales, and she got 9,557 votes. When it came to the Deputy General Secretary election, John Maloney was returned. He is a member of the Alliance for Workers' Liberty. He got 11,705 votes compared with Paul O'Connor, who's a sitting official, not an elected member of the executive or anything like that. He got 8,152 votes. And just to comment on this, what was significant about the domination of the left isn't just the fact that these factions used to be united in a single faction that used to be united behind Mark Sawatka, that under Mark Sawatka's leadership, under Mark Sawatka as general secretary, there were moves by him which I thoroughly approved of. To get the PCS to affiliate to the Labour Party in order to take part in the civil war in the Labour Party after Jeremy Corbyn was elected. And it was the comrades in the Socialist Party in England and Wales in particular who fought that and successfully fought that. And that was one of the issues that led to the split. Between on the one side, Mark Sawatka, and on the other side, the Socialist Party in England and Wales. It's worth noting that the last election there was, I think Mark Sawatka has won five elections as General Secretary, but the last one, which saw him obviously returned, had a turnout of 18.6 percent. So it's clear that there's mass disillusionment in the ranks of the more conscious elements, politically conscious elements in the union. And it's also clear that the left is divided, but not divided to the point where the right comes back and recaptures the union. Lastly, I just thought I would stir the hornet's nest, as it's the end of the year, and just throw in a few thoughts about the Soviet Union. I'm not going to do a big long talk, but simply to intervene in how do we classify it? How do we weigh up, what happened in the Soviet Union, not only from 1917, but what were the results, and how should we characterize its collapse? My own take at the time was that I saw it coming. I didn't want it to come. I thought there was a possibility, at least, of something I would characterize as a political revolution, obviously following in the footsteps of Trotsky and the left opposition and the Fourth International. I wasn't a co-thinker, but nonetheless, we in the Leninist, we made the call for the overthrow, not only of Gorbachev as an individual, but the regime. And we thought that the working class at least could do it. There was the possibility of it doing. But if it didn't, we were certainly not of the opinion of William Rees-Mogg, who was the editor, the father of, yes, you guessed it. We weren't of the opinion that the overthrow of what we called, and I still would for want of another word, bureaucratic socialism, that would lead somehow to the flourishing of capitalism, and therefore Russians enjoying, Canadian levels of agricultural productivity and Swedish levels of social security and German levels of living standards. My own take was that even though living standards in the Soviet Union were low compared with Canada, compared with Sweden, compared with Germany, they would crash. That was my fear. I don't need to make the point again. Look what happened. And I was also not of the view that if things weren't resolved positively, i.e., if the working class in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union didn't act and assert their hegemony, which I thought was an outside possibility, I thought collapse was much more likely. In my estimate, what was going to happen in what I'll call the West was a period of reaction of a special type, special, sui generis. Why? Because I didn't think that in such a period the left was going to be persecuted. We weren't going to find our publications banned. We weren't going to find ourselves in jail. We weren't going to find ourselves in exile. But what we would find ourselves is incredibly marginalized. It's true that punters outside Sainsbury's, would cease very quickly in telling people to get back to Russia. But instead, they would still be shouting, in my estimate, look what happened in Russia. It failed. Are you still banging your head against, a brick wall? What's wrong with you? And so people wouldn't have aggression against you. It would be much more sort of compassion for someone who's suffering from a mental illness, almost someone who's deluded So you have some sort of fellow feeling for them. People would recognize that you're well-meaning but rather stupid. Well, all I would say is when we look back at the collapse of the Soviet Union, I have to say that I find myself vindicated. I don't say that with any pleasure. I'd love to have been wrong. I'd love to have been in a situation where we're looking at, the working class in power in the former Soviet Union, or maybe it would still be called the Soviet Union. I'd love to be in a situation that the SWP comrades, that the SPU comrades, Peter Taff, who talked about the red 1990s, I'd love it if they were right, but they were wrong. But at the same time, I think we also need to recognize that it isn't an either or. And the fact of the matter is, if we look at the role of the Soviet Union, while it undoubtedly played a role, in shaping the world, in terms of, the welfare state, I mean, as a negative reaction, living standards, universal suffrage, all of this owed at least something in the West to the existence of the Soviet Union. But at the same time, all we need to do is look at the official communist parties, not what they're doing today, but what they did previously, to see the role of the Soviet Union in holding back and diverting the working class. And it diverted the working class in two main ways, in my view. First of all, of course, official communist parties were obliged, until we saw the rise of Eurocommunism, bourgeois socialism, wanted to do a deal with the capitalist class. Until we saw the rise of Eurocommunism, official communist parties were obliged to defend, in one way or another, the Soviet Union, Eastern Europe, China, as some sort of example, indeed, even a model of socialism to aspire to. And of course, the majority of workers in advanced capitalist countries, America, Canada, Sweden, Germany, Britain, said, well, if that's what you aspire to, I really don't want anything to do with it, let alone the denial of democratic rights. But also, we need to bear in mind the role of the Soviet Union in killing off revolutions, limiting revolutions, diverting official communist parties towards popular fronts that were designed for the purposes of Soviet diplomacy, that where you had mass communist parties often led to disastrous results. So I'm thinking of the Popular Front government in France, the Popular Front government in Spain, but also look at the so-called Third World. Look at the Communist Party in Egypt and how it was sold to Nasser. Look at the Communist Party in Iraq, Syria, Iran, today in relationship to the Shah, and then finally, of course, Khomeini, and one can go on and on and on. So the Soviet Union, I think, had, how should you put it, a complex effect. And I think it would be mistaken to simply say that the collapse of the Soviet Union was a disaster, because it had to collapse. And we also need to bear in mind that it was collapsed from within. Yes, there was pressure from the United States, NATO, rollback, Carter Doctrine, Ronald Reagan, and all the rest of it. But also, what we had is the running out of steam of that system, and the decision by at least leading elements in the bureaucracy to attempt, and they did it, didn't they, to join the capitalist class. Of course, what they did is not join the capitalist class as an equal in terms of state terms, as Yeltsin soon discovered. But nonetheless, what we had is the so-called oligarchs joining the international bourgeoisie and going from their privileges, sort of hidden away, sort of behind high walls, to a situation where they could flaunt it, of where they could buy their football clubs where they could send their children to English public schools, where they could buy their mansions in France and have their wealth inherited by their children. Anyway, I thought I would finish with that, really, with the idea of comrades arguing that one out, because as I've tried to indicate, I think that the answer is complex. It's not a simple answer.